Welcome to The Commentary, a weekly conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace Presbyterian Church. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace. And my guest in this episode is Maestro Delta David Geyer. David and I have hosted two seasons of the Hearing the Music podcast together. So we have a history of getting together to talk about the spiritual and theological dimensions behind great music. A couple of weeks ago, David celebrated his 20th anniversary as music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, concluding the season with a magnificent performance of Gustav Mahler's Third Symphony. During the introduction to that piece, David made an observation that set my mind racing and ultimately led to this interview. In this episode, we'll be discussing the spiritual longing found in so much music and art of post-Enlightenment culture. We'll also talk about how work like this can break in on 21st century life and summon us to pay attention to transcendence. David, for the 20th anniversary concert, the last concert of this past season, you had the opportunity to choose any piece that you wanted, and you chose Mahler's Third Symphony. Why? Of all the pieces that you could have performed, why Mahler and why the Third Symphony?
I have an affinity for Mahler in general, but that particular symphony struck me from, I know I was about 20 years old or something when I heard it for the first time, and was just really enamored with particularly the opening of it. There were such new sounds that I'd never heard before, and the power of that work, the sweep of it. I guess even at the time I sensed a sort of innate spirituality to the piece. I mean, the last movement, the culmination of the work is basically a hymn. It spoke to me very deeply, as it does to pretty much everybody who hears it.
So for people who are listening and are not very familiar with Gustav Mahler, could you just explain to us a little bit like where he falls in the classical music timeline and maybe what he represents for the tradition?
Well, so we're talking end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. He died in 1911. So he sort of the pinnacle of the Romantic era. And, you know, very much, you know, coming out of a Germanic tradition extending back to Bach, but through Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and Wagner, through that, in the last couple hundred years of that Germanic history of music in those German-speaking countries.
So one of the comments that you made when you introduced the symphony at the concert was that you saw Mahler as a God seeker. And that intrigued me, and I wanted to unpack that a little bit. When you hear Mahler's music or think about him, what is it about that makes you think that he was a God seeker?
Well, I'm not alone in this at all. He dealt with spiritual subjects throughout the course of his career. Unusually, he was Jewish, raised in Bohemia, spent most of his life in Vienna, although he did, towards the end of his life, had 3 years in New York City, conducting both the Met and the New York Philharmonic right before he died. But he always seemed to gravitate towards either Christian texts or texts that had to do coming out of Christianity. There's certainly Jewish influence in his music. You can hear it, even klezmer kinds of music from time to time, but in terms of, you know, anything theological, he was much more on the side of Christianity. It was after this symphony was composed, but he did convert to Catholicism in Vienna, and the common parlance is that he did it in order to gain a post, a conducting post, the highest post in Vienna, conducting at the opera. I don't really buy that he just did it out of convenience. because of the text that he was always engaging in. So I also have been impressed from the very beginning with the sensitivity that he, with which he approached these texts musically. I mean, the high standard for that is Bach, right? He's text painting and music. So, but Mahler didn't always do it with the text so much, but the feeling of it, you know, or setting it, you know, in a certain style, or, you know, getting the text to really line up with the music that he was composing. And it says to me, and to pretty much anyone else who's paying attention, that this is something that he believed, you know, that he internalized.
Mm-hmm. So in the choice of the text, I think that's the level that I can see it more easily.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying there's also on the level of the music something that suggests that searching.
Right, for sure. I mean, you get intimations of it early on in his output, but then you get to, you know, a monumental work like his Eighth Symphony, which is known as the Symphony of 1,000, because there were over 1,000 people participating musically in the premiere of that piece. Astonishing. But the text for the lengthy first movement of that piece is from a 9th century Christian hymn.
Hmm.
You know, Veni Creator Spiritus. And the second part of that is the closing scene of Goethe's Faust, which seems like an unusual pairing, but it also, even though, you know, like Goethe, again, not a card-carrying Christian per se, but it definitely has that, you know, Christian underpinnings,
mm-hmm,
of that. And the way that Mahler sets those texts, not simply sensitive to the text, but again, internalizing it, that first movement is a paean of praise,
mm-hmm,
you know, and it's just says that this is something he believed.
Well, you talked about juxtaposing unusual texts, mm-hmm, and in the Third Symphony, I mean, there's a great example of that,
mm-hmm,
where is it in the third movement that the
fourth,
the fourth, yeah, in the fourth movement, he takes a text of Friedrich Nietzsche's,
right,
from also Sprach Zarathustra, which is the work that is famous for that line, God is dead and we have killed him,
mm-hmm,
sets that to music, the Midnight Song, is that?
Mm-hmm.
But
right,
then in the very next movement, he sets an interesting redemption hymn that has kind of an unusual providence, mm-hmm, to it.
Yeah, for sure. You could think of those last three movements out of the six movements. You could think of those last three movements as a unit, beginning with the song, and the song is sung by a mezzo soprano with the orchestra. It's the first time that a voice appears in this work, and the first words that she speaks are, "O mankind, take heed. What does the deep midnight say?" It's a warning about mankind and our propensities. But at one point else in the text, it says, deep is the world's woe, and deeper than the heart's sorrow. But woe speaks and says, but all desire yearns for eternity. So these are all very poetic lines, but the trajectory, it goes from this darkness to light. It goes from this warning for mankind to take heed to this idea of yearning for eternity. It's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of glorious music in that Third Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
It's 100 minutes long, as you experience.
Right.
But
that is remarkable. Just that idea that, I mean, that's Nietzsche.
Yes. Right?
That you could imagine a kind of, I don't know, ideal church service in which this song is being sung and you feel very moved and convicted by it, and then look down and notice, oh, text by Friedrich Nietzsche, and become,
right,
very confused. But I mean, maybe that just speaks to the obvious fact that Nietzsche, like any human thinker, is more complex than the sound bites give credit for.
Oh, please. Son of a Lutheran pastor, yeah, you right, know, and right. grandson of a Lutheran pastor, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but it's an interesting text. I think, you know, for Mahler to choose and mm-hmm. then to juxtapose with, you know, very the sort of simple faith mm-hmm. in view in the following movement is really fascinating.
Right. Well, that following movement is, you know, it tells a childlike story of Peter's restoration. It gets the timeline a little screwed up theologically, but it's folksy. It uses bells and a children's chorus, and again the alto soloist is there playing the role of Peter at the Last Supper, and Jesus, you know, says to him, you know, whenever I look at you, you're weeping, and Peter says, well, shouldn't I weep? You know, I've broken the Ten Commandments, and he ends up by saying, have mercy on me, and the movement ends with the angels joyfully saying, you know, if you've broken the Ten Commandments, then fall on your knees and pray to God, love only God from now to eternity, you know. So again, theologically, it's a little mixed up. Because we know that at the Last Supper, Peter has not yet denied Christ.
Sure.
You know, I mean, breaking the Ten Commandments aside, but still, it's the, you know, it's that juxtaposition you're talking about of, like, this very serious, you know, song of, you know, based on Nietzsche, and then this childlike view of God, of
right.
simple faith.
Right. Well, you know, and I think that's. There's always the temptation to overparse the theology of this and that, but I feel like if you're starting with Nietzsche and then you're moving to this, that you get a lot of credit for just the general moves. I mean, I remember thinking and hearing that love only God echoes of, you know, I could imagine C.S. Lewis grinding his teeth mm-hmm. because he hates that idea in Augustine that if you love God, you'll never be disappointed, but all your earthly loves will lead to disappointment because he sees all of those earthly loves as pointing to,
of course,
and perfected in the love of God. But I suspended that critical spirit
right.
as I experienced the music, you know.
But Mahler was never a churchgoer,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a lot of, I mean, you know, you could say the same about Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
These were also a God seeker.
Yeah.
You know, Brahms, you know, these were not, they're very, very 21st century in there. In the way that they approached things of the spirit, all of them very biblically literate
mm-hmm.
at the time during the 19th century, but, you know, not vapid in the sense of, oh, I'm spiritual, but not religious.
Sure.
You know, and there's none of that. I mean, these are really deep God seekers and that Germanic philosophical artistic tradition, it's rich.
So there's something about that tradition that you introduced me to, which is the idea kind of summed up in the word Sehnsucht.
Right.
Longing.
Spiritual yearning.
And so that's a theme in a lot of that German music
yes.
throughout the period. What is Sehnsucht all about?
Well, it is that you know, Augustine, the God-shaped hole in us, you know, that yearns for fulfillment. And, you know, what I see, not just in the 19th century, but in my art form in general, are not just composers, but also performers as mistaking the gift for the giver.
Mm.
You know, it's like pouring your life into music, pouring your life into the art, because it moves us so deeply. It's such a powerful medium when it's so masterfully composed and it's so much, you know, gorgeousness.
Right.
In the music, and it just envelops us. But it's the temptation is to worship that in and of itself. But these composers, you know, you're dealing with things of the spirit, and they knew it. Beethoven knew it. Brahms knew it. Mahler, they knew that they were dealing with deep things of the spirit, even if they couldn't exactly put their finger on it. And their purpose for creating beauty was to, not just for themselves, but for other people, to draw mm-hmm. other people into that search. They they all at least believed that they were participating in something much larger than themselves, and that it was for the betterment of our society, that people could be ennobled, encouraged, uplifted through the music that they were composing. It was not merely about self-expression.
Sure.
Which is how we, you know, ever throughout the 20th century and up to now, we think of artists creating art for self-expression. For, you know, for Bach, this would have been a totally foreign concept.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, it does feel like that tradition of artists is engaging with and reacting to the outside world, not just the interior world of the mm-hmm. self, but, I mean, obviously longing and seeking after God does have an interior aspect to it, but it's also like a longing directed outside of oneself. And it doesn't surprise me that in the 19th century that would be increasingly pronounced, because this is the period where cultures are coming to terms with the idea of the absence of God.
Yeah.
And so they are, in a sense, losing the theological, and that loss, I think, creates a sense for maybe the dislocation of the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if we don't have the theological framework that we once did, what does that make of our human longings? You know, you talked about Augustine earlier, and Augustine, the beginning of the confession, says, you know, you made us for yourself and our hearts are restless until they find rest in you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sense of longing is a good expression of the restlessness. And maybe there's just added to it, and this is the Nietzsche influence, I guess, but added to it is that sense that it's a restlessness and a longing that possibly cannot be fulfilled, or at least its fulfillment feels farther than it ever has.
Right. Well, it goes back to the C.S. Lewis thing. Like, you know, if we find ourselves unfulfilled, it's probably because we were created for something beyond.
Right.
I'm not getting the quote exactly right, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, throughout the 19th century, in my art form, that you're exactly right. I mean, we're coming right on the heels of the Enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
which was actually brought home to me in a very stark way. A couple of summers ago, I was visiting a friend in Cluny in France, and I got off the train, and we spent a couple of hours traipsing through Cluny, and he was showing me the ruins of what had been the center of Christianity before Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And these, you know, there were models, reconstructions of these incredible buildings in this relatively small town of Cluny. And he explained that the reason that this town was in ruins was because the proponents of the Enlightenment dismantled this and sold off all of the stone, not simply for money, but to actually dismantle Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were after. He described it as purely demonic.
Yeah.
Like, so it left this culturally, not just personally, but culturally, this God-shaped hole in European life. And when I see Beethoven and Schumann and Brahms and Mahler, you know, when striving towards this spiritual thing, I see them as trying to fill exactly that hole.
Right, right. Well, you know, and I found myself thinking about that idea of being a God seeker and trying to think in other art forms of examples of people I could point to and say, you know, here's a good example. And I kept coming back to Albert Camus in the 20th century as someone who, even when he is advocating for atheism, even when he is writing about rejecting the plan of salvation, there feels like there's something in his writing that is sort of backed with a yearning. I don't believe this is true, if only it were. something like that, you know.
Well, it's back to Nietzsche again.
Yes.
I think there's some very parallel there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think it's, you know, as someone who has that faith, you know, can look upon that situation of being a God seeker with sympathy, but also with like a, like you want to see those longings fulfilled. I think it can be helpful to connect with artists who are expressing that yearning, right? It can be easy for the believer to forget what that yearning is like and to make the mistake of thinking, all my longings are fulfilled now, and not see the ways in which we continue to seek God and continue to long for a fuller understanding or experience of Him, which I think is what work like this invites us into.
Well, and I think that as 21st century believers, that this is our catalyst to those who don't believe or don't yet believe, because it is that window between, well, it's our window into their lives. You can, if you can identify that yearning in someone, and it's their window into Christ.
Right.
Because I mean, like, you know, I remember sitting in my living room a year ago or so talking with a very close friend, and you know, this person was basically telling me that you know, Wagner's music was his God. You know, and you know, I can understand becoming enraptured in the music of Wagner. It's quite something, but this led to much deeper spiritual conversation. It was like, okay, so like, you know, it got down to that, mistaking the gift for the giver. Like, don't you think there's anything behind that? What, you know, what is it that you experience?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a person who's been a musician his entire life. So, you know, what is it that you experience in music? And it comes down to joy. That's what it is. I mean, those of us in classical music in particular, we're joy junkies, basically. Like, you know, like nobody does joy like Beethoven, you know, or somebody else said at one point, you never have to ask a classical musician what transcendence is, because it's where we live.
Yeah.
So we have this wonderful art form that we're part of, but you know, the conversation goes, you know, like, okay, so what do you experience? You experience joy. What's the source of the joy? Is it just a tickly feeling in your stomach and then an exalted sense, or is there something more? And if there is, then what is that?
Yeah.
It, you know, it's like C.S. Lewis is surprised by joy.
Right, right. I was reading recently a theologian talking about the way that in the 21st century, believers and unbelievers alike all have a heightened perception of the absence of God. That it's not that, you know, believers go around feeling God's presence and unbelievers feel His absence. Right. Everyone in the 21st century has that sense of absence. Mm-hmm. It's part of being a product of our culture. And it does strike me that one of the things that preserving music like this and performing it today does is similar to what I often argue to people is the value of having a confession of faith that wasn't written yesterday, that it's an anchor outside of time, that it connects us with a world where that sense of absence was much less baked in to people's sensibility than it is today. So that we have in art an artifact of that sense of God's presence, and it continues to point towards that fuller reality, even though we oftentimes tell ourselves like we no longer and can no longer believe in the world where all of these longings make sense and all of these transcendent things like beauty are real and not just constructs. But to me, that becomes a powerful argument from a Christian perspective for why we should continue to, you know, not only support the performance of great symphonies like this, but also to be like present for it, mm-hmm. you know, and to experience the challenge of that seeking, because I feel like we need that awakening as much as anyone.
Yeah. And it's not just individual, it's corporate.
Yeah.
I mean, you experience it yourself. And I often talk with you, both the orchestra and the audience, about the community that comes together. Like, there's something, you know, extremely powerful about getting 100 musicians on stage solely devoted to the performance of the singularly focused on the performance of a great work of art. That in and of itself is a creation of community, but we're not doing it simply for ourselves. And we don't look at it as you know, us performing and the audience simply listening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we look at it as everybody participating in the experience of it together. And we're the ones there, musicians, we're the ones who are facilitating this corporate experience. And maybe because it's our art form is not amplified,
mm-hmm.
there's a real visceral connection to people. The vibrations that are coming off the stage are not mitigated by some sort of electronic
right.
thing. You know, you're getting like a purer vibration of, you know, a chorus of string instruments or brass instruments or whatever. And it resonates in your body differently, you know, as a result. And there are, you know, in those silences, you know, we can hear people breathe. Unfortunately, occasionally we also hear the cell phones of people who forgot to silence their cell phones before the concert began.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting to me because I found myself listening to the Mahler Third Symphony, thinking about that quote of his that a symphony must contain whole world. Because I guess I've always thought of that more in terms of the ideas, like the ideas are so broad, and the symphony is sort of one symphony somehow has the breadth of a world. But this time around, I was really struck by just the idea that it kind of takes a world in order to enact it,
mm-hmm.
right? That mm-hmm. in a sense, a performance like this becomes almost a bellwether for civilization. Like, as long as we can still do this,
mm-hmm.
as long as we can still produce all of these musicians, right? Because just every person on that stage has to be formed mm-hmm. through a lifetime of discipline and
right.
to be able to do that and then bring them all together and perform a work like this. You know, I have to feel like if we can still pull this off, there is hope for us yet.
Well, there's also a sense in which, I mean, the community itself having a symphony orchestra, period.
Yes.
Like what it takes for a community to put 80 to 100 musicians on stage on a regular basis, that's a lot of money. And the concert hall itself and all of that, like I mean, our orchestra is over 100 years old. So Sioux Falls, you know, was very young. The state was less than 30 years old when the South Dakota Symphony began.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really important to the people who founded this, that there be an orchestra. But as a symphony orchestra goes, often the rest of the arts in the community go. Because it takes so much commitment from the community to have this institution, it takes less money to put together an art gallery mm-hmm. or something like that, you know. But because the community has decided that this is important, then the enrichment of the life of the community is it flows out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we've talked about this before, but I think you can say similar things about the life of the church.
Absolutely.
You know, that the extent to which we have that sense that we're not just individuals before God, but are a community brought together by Him, meant to be in relationship with one another, meant to do together what we could never do on our own. I think a lot of that sense of coming together to do these things is the same.
Perhaps extra important now that our lives are so isolated from, you know, the electronic media. We
right.
spend so much time and we're sequestered in our homes watching Netflix and mm-hmm. not communing with one another.
Right.
When there was a time when if you wanted to hear music, you had to go elsewhere or make it yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the only two options until the 20th century and electronic media started. So now we continue to isolate so that I can have whatever I want on my phone.
Right.
Whenever I want it.
Right.
But I don't share, and if we share, quote unquote, it's by sending electronic things to one another so that you can, in your time, in your place, and you know, to be able to experience it rather than coming together. So the church, obviously the supreme example of coming together, but also these cultural events, these cultural institutions that invite people to come and experience important events together.
Yeah.
It enriches all of us.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this before, just in the most basic level, that I think there's a good spiritual discipline to be observed in attending the symphony, because it is a structure which encourages you to sit and do quote unquote nothing apart from listening. Whereas we are so accustomed to multitasking, to never being attentive to any one thing, so that even the things we're kind of paying attention to, we don't fully attend to. Mm-hmm. I think in the same way that sitting through a church service attentively is harder for people now than it's ever been before. Mm-hmm. I think it's true for a concert as well, but that difficulty is easily overcome. And that's the key, that people imagine how difficult it would be. But after you're sort of over that threshold, like I was never a person who could just sit and listen and not be doing something else. And it was very surprising to me how quickly that changed and also how beneficial it was.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And we're participating in a long history. Here we're connecting ourselves to the past, we're connecting ourselves to each other. And when we do take the time to be quiet and listen and be attentive, it's my personal belief that when this music transports us, allows us to transcend the specific moment, that there's a space. I think a lot of people would look at it as a philosophical space that we're taken to, and these composers would have thought, you know, this is where we were trying to go. But I would also argue that the Holy Spirit inhabits that space when we elevate our thoughts, not just for the sake of elevating them, but we're literally transcendent, that we have the opportunity then to open ourselves up to, and maybe it's just to things higher to begin with, but again, that there's a window there that we have the opportunity to allow the Holy Spirit to work on us.
Thank you for listening to the commentary. If you've enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends on social media. You can also rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you haven't already subscribed to the commentary, you can do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. That way, you'll never miss a new episode. For more music discussion between me and David, check out the Hearing the Music podcast. You'll find it online at hearingthemusic.org. And for more information about Grace or to check out our other podcasts, visit us at graceforsiouxfalls.org.